Hello, welcome to this Institute for Government event on the recruitment and retention of top talent in the civil service. And a particular welcome to all those in the room who've overcome the train strikes to be here, but also, of course, to everybody online. This subject goes to the heart of what an impartial and effective British civil service should be all about. The foundational Northcote Trevelyan report 170 years ago focused on the skills, talent and recruitment of the civil service, arguing that, quote, people of the highest abilities should be selected for the highest posts. And more recent government plans in 2021 talked about attracting a broader range of people to the privilege of public service. But is enough being done to recruit and retain the best? Is the culture in the civil service welcoming enough for external recruits? And do the right jobs exist for the right people? And what sort of skills does the civil service need? My name is Alex Thomas. I am a programme director here at the IFG. And to discuss this, we have not one, not two, but three permanent secretaries. The BGs, or the Destiny's Child, pick your comparison, depending on your generation, the Goodies, the Three Musketeers, the Three Wise People, enough of that, of Whitehall. And they all have substantial experience both inside and outside the civil service. So on my left, Sarah Mumby is the Permanent Secretary at the Department for Science, Innovation and Technology. Kat Little on the screen, victim of the train strikes, is the newly installed Chief Operating Officer for the Civil Service and Permanent Secretary at the Cabinet Office. And Gareth Davis is the Permanent Secretary at the Department for Business and Trade. And my colleague Jordan Urban is with us to share some of our research, including from a forthcoming paper coming out later this week about the most senior officials in the civil service that we've produced in partnership with the organisational consulting firm Korn Ferry. Before we get going then, here's a first call for questions. Get thinking in the room here. For those tuning in remotely, use the Slido function on the screen, the button that you can see. And when you ask a question, if you can say who you are and what organisation you're from. The Twitter hashtag is hashtag civil service, so also follow and tweet along. Sarah, it's going to start with you. You were a civil servant at the very start of your career. We were talking in the green room earlier how we were both in DEFRA, started our careers in DEFRA at the same time in the early noughties. But then you established most of your career in McKinsey before returning in 2019. Talk us through that. How did you find leaving and then coming back into government from the outside? What were the surprises? What were the things that were as you expected?
Well, when I rejoined, so about 5 years ago, I came into what was then BEIS as a director general, with actually quite little experience of the civil service and the public sector. And although I was in consulting before, I hadn't been consulting to the public sector. So I got a lot of sort of pre-warnings about what it was going to be like, most of which were almost completely false. And I think the two big kind of surprises on the upside, and then I'll talk about what I think people should really be talking about when they're discussing joining the civil service with outsiders. The first one was the people. I came from an organisation that thought of itself as pretty hot on talent, and I've been, you know, incredibly impressed with the quality of my colleagues. Obviously, setting present company aside, we are incredibly lucky, I think, with the people who were able not just to attract into the civil service, but to build as colleagues in the civil service. These are very, very tough jobs with a whole plethora of different skills required. And I think we have some amazing people. So that's been a huge pleasure and kind of an upside surprise. And the other thing that everybody wants to tell you about is how it's all going to be very slow moving. Very slow moving, very bureaucratic. And I have to say, I have not experienced it as slow moving. Indeed, I mean, if I was going to criticise the pace of government, I'd actually talk about how sometimes we act too quickly. Maybe it's an artefact in part of what the last few years have looked like. But a lot of the time it's felt like operating at warp speed. And the scale of impact that we've been able to have is really incredible. And ultimately, I think a huge amount of the value proposition is... work with some truly fantastic colleagues on the biggest and most important issues that the country faces. And it's pretty simple. What I think wasn't talked about enough at least to me, is I think there is one really fundamental shift, which is very clear and obvious, I'm sure, to everyone in this room, but is very different from, you know, any other organisation I had worked, you know, with, and I'd had the privilege of seeing lots, which is that ultimately we're here to serve ministers. And that change from having a level of personal executive authority and being part of a kind of a delegated decision-making framework like you are in a normal PLC, I think that is deeply and fundamentally different. And I'm sure we'll come on to talk about this, but I think that mindset shift, that new way of operating, is one of the transitions that we have to really help people with as they move into the civil service. And then I think the other thing is just to recognise that there are an enormous number of skills that are about the skill of government. And sometimes in our rush to sort of praise the skills of people outside government and to celebrate the brilliant things that the private sector can bring into government, of which there are many, we're a bit too slow to talk about the expertise of what it means to be a fantastic official, whether that's working with ministers, working with parliament, understanding the case for government intervention, you know, learning from history. There's a huge amount there that is a real skill, and you know, that's at large scale, right? The civil service is a huge employer, and I think it's right that we have our own skill set, just like, you know, the retail industry or the energy industry would think about itself as having some deeply particular skills. I think that's true of government as well, and you know, maybe people don't spend quite enough time reminding you that maybe you don't know it all as you make that transition.
Thank you. Howard, say a little bit more about your personal then, sort of your return to government in that. Did you'd obviously you had been a civil servant before, but not much. What was the, did you feel helped to rebuild those skills, or was there more that the civil service should be doing to kind of recognise that?
I think it's probably like any senior executive transition. You know, it's actually quite hard starting a new job at a really senior level. Public sector, private sector, third sector, whatever you're doing, you know, you've got to, I think, to some extent, take responsibility for your own transition. There was an induction program. I had a mentor, all of those things. But actually, you know, you, like anything, I think you probably learn most on the job. I mean, Kat would probably talk to it more eloquently, but I know we're, you know, doing some thinking about how do you strengthen those things, particularly to capture that bit of, you know, how does government work? The things that you won't really have learned or seen on the outside, just to help people come up that curve even faster.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Tease up, Kat, the question I was going to ask you, which is, you know, are we barking up the right tree here? Why should we care about external recruits and finding talent externally? What is the civil service doing that about that at the moment? But also, kind of how supporting people to make the transition? Yeah, should we be caring about this?
Well, simply yes, and it's a fantastic subject in my first outing at the Cabinet Office in my new role to be talking with you and colleagues about, because it matters more than ever. We do really diverse things in the civil service, so it matters that we have diverse skills, diverse experience and diverse expertise. We've also got a real need to increase the number of specialist skills that we have a need in the future in the civil service. So we know that we've got gaps in quite a lot of our tech and specialist corporate skills. We don't just want to be playing catch up. We want to be thinking about the skills that we need in the future as well. And we also know that we deliver better outcomes and deliver better for the public when we've got diversity of thought, diversity of background. So it really, really matters. And we've been doing lots, and I recognise that there's still a lot that we need to do, but just to give you a few things that have changed. So since we brought in external recruitment by default, we now have over 93% of roles going out externally. And of course, if we're not actually asking people if they'd like to join the civil service, that's probably quite a large barrier. So that's a big shift in culture and a big shift in processes. We're also about to launch our attraction strategy that's got five different pillars to it. So very briefly, changing and actually boosting people's understanding of the civil service. How many people pick up a job advert and seeing, I have no idea what that means. So actually explaining what we do, education about jobs, making sure that our job adverts on civil service jobs are understandable. We're doing lots to improve candidate reach. We've got more capability in the civil service to think about who actually work on attraction as a specific HR professional talent. We're doing more to have more inclusive candidate experiences, and the Civil Service Commission plays a really important role in helping us to make sure that as you go through recruitment, it actually makes sense if you're not from within the civil service. And we're trying to join up more on core skills. So the DDAP function is a really good example where we're trying to do more together across departments so that when we go to market, we're doing it as one civil service as a team. So there's lots of things that are changing, but I think we all recognise that there are always going to be some challenges that we have to keep trying to overcome.
Thanks, Kat. And just picking up on one particular area you mentioned there, because I can already see lots of questions coming in online talking about success profiles and things like that. So we may dig into that a bit later. But just generally on the sort of qualities that the civil service looks for in its external recruitment and how those are kind of described, do you feel you have a sense yet of the extent to which that might sort of change or evolve, and success profiles get a bit of stick, but equally the kind of skills that they're looking for are there? It's that kind of how much do you think is likely to change in that area, I guess?
So I think it's already changed quite a lot. So we tend to talk more about strengths and behaviours and characteristics rather than what people do. And in many ways, especially at senior levels, you know, how we do our job is as relevant to what we actually do. There are certain jobs that need a bit more translation, and there are some departments that have a few more acronyms that need a bit more translation. When I worked at the Ministry of Defence, I spent a lot of time trying to work out exactly what jobs I was recruiting for, let alone explaining to future candidates. So it is changing a lot. And when I was listening to Sarah, I think the main thing I was thinking is we spend a lot of our time overgeneralising about the differences between the private and the public sector. What I would want to emphasise is just what we've got in common. And I really felt this recently when we launched our new government finance function attraction website, because in many professions we use the same language, the same job families, the same skills, the same expertise, the same standards in public. So we should be emphasising the things that are common, not the things that people quite lazily generalise about between the public and the private sector.
Thanks, Kat. So Gareth, how different is the government to other organisations?
So I've worked in, obviously, the civil service. I started my career in a large consultancy, which is across Western Europe. And I've also spent 2 years in a large financial services company based across Asia. And in some ways, having worked in those large organisations and then spent time with small businesses, startup scale, I think the biggest difference actually is large versus small organisations rather than public-private. You know, small organisations, when you get to know everyone, you've got to be nimble, agile, there's a sense of, you know, that entrepreneurial spirit runs through it is one thing. But all large organisations, as Kat says, they've got their own language, they've got their own acronyms, they have their explicit rules of the game, they have the real rules of the game that you've got to work out how things really operate. And it takes you time to adjust to the operating context. And that can vary between insurers in a sector, between sectors, just as it does between government departments. So in some ways, we can overstate the differences. But there are important things that to succeed in the public sector. I think people, as they come across, we need to be better at explaining how to operate and how that works. I think, Sarah, the way you talk about the role of ministers is really important distinction. I found as a consultant coming into the public sector, the mental model I had about working with clients and serving clients, whilst not perfect, had a lot of applicability to the way in which we operate with ministers. In contrast, when I was in Hong Kong, in an insurance company there, if you were the head of insurance in Hong Kong, you had a lot of autonomy. You had some rules of the road, but frankly, your job was to go and sell products. And you didn't need to check in that often back to HQ. Our job is much more integrated upwards to ministers between ourselves. So the level of independence you've got is very small. And the mantra I always say to new starters is, Whitehall government is a team sport. You're not going to get much done on your own. You've really got to build coalitions to make change happen.
And you're all this is a common theme of the IFG, but you're all permanent secretaries of individual departments. Mm-hmm. Then we talk about the civil service as one thing. And then we also talk, and you touched on it there, about the wider public sector. Again, there's a danger, I think, the debate can get sort of into a polarised private sector versus civil service. And there's more opportunity to make use of the public sector. But how far should we be thinking of the civil service as one organisation that needs its own controlling mind, setting recruitment and HR policies, you know, CCAT? Yeah. And how far as individual fiefdoms for your you know, permanent secretaries to, you know, swagger around doing their thing?
And you want to solve that 150-year question in the next half hour? Excellent,
horizontal,
that sounds great.
Crack on.
I think, look, there's incredible variation. I mean, there's 500,000 of us. Yeah. And the variation between someone who's doing a really tough job with someone who's been on, say, incapacity benefit for many years, trying to coach them back to work, versus someone, say, working in Sarah's department on AI policy and the future of regulation, versus someone who's working in my shop on, say, export controls. These are incredibly varied jobs. So I think talking about 500,000, I think it just you lose too much in a generalisation. I think the work we've done on professionalisation and the functions has had a incredible impact over the last 15 years. And as Kat touches on, that's the way in which you can start to unlock this. Because there are industry-specific skills and knowledge you need. Just as if you're moving from retail to banking, there are different contexts you're operating in. But if you've got the core professional skills, be it in finance, be it in HR, be it in digital, that helps. And I think the real thing we need to focus on now actually to really unlock this benefit of helping people move charities, public sector, private sector into the civil service is having a bit more of the formalisation, call it standardisation, but making explicit what the policy-making process is. For too long, that's been a bit of a seen as a sort of essentially an art form that can't be written down, and you sort of pick it up almost by osmosis. And I think that's wrong. I think there's been some really good work that's blocked people moving in from the private sector. It blocks people moving in from non-traditional backgrounds into the civil service and stops them not just coming in, but also succeeding and thriving. I think that's the thing. That's the sort of thing I'd love to focus on in terms of what could really make the difference.
Great. And plenty in our back catalogue and more to come in the IFG about defining policymaking and what that what that's about. So, you know, keep in touch on that. Jordan, we've got a report coming out in a couple of days. You've looked at the sort of what used to be called the top 200, the permanent secretaries and directors general, the information that is publicly available and that we could find out and draw on some conclusions on that. What does our research tell us about how the civil service recruits?
That's my value add to the panel today because I've not been a permanent secretary. So I mean,
give it time.
Yeah. I mean, as Alex says, been looking at kind of the professional and personal background of director generals, permanent secretaries in ministerial departments. I think there are sort of three main themes that are particularly interesting that I just wanted to draw out today. The first, kind of starting at the very beginning, is educational background. So we looked at DGs and perm secs and found that 23% of those top officials had done an undergraduate degree in STEM. That's compared to 44% of UK graduates as a whole. That's a fair difference. That helps explain some of the kind of oft-leveled criticisms at senior officials that maybe they're a bit more comfortable on kind of qualitative than quantitative questions, although that is obviously changing. Interestingly, found that only sort of 5 non-science or medical professionals, so sort of chief scientific advisors and stuff excluded, had done STEM at postgrad level. So that's really interesting looking at the kind of relative lack of kind of advanced STEM skills at kind of the top level of the civil service. And that's partly because of the kind of jobs that are there as well as anything else. In terms of kind of amount of time spent outside government, there's actually more than you'd think compared to some of the kind of slightly exaggerated commentary in this question. I think it's fair to say that it tends to be sort of shallower and for shorter time periods earlier in careers, but it does exist. Be interested in kind of the rest of the panel's thoughts on this question, which we've kind of debated a bit internally, and kind of interviewees have different opinions about the extent to which you should ever directly hire in a permanent secretary from outside, or whether you do sort of need to understand government and actually specifically the department and the kind of unique setting of the civil service ministerial relationship before you can really kind of reach the top of the shop. I think with DGs, my personal view, but again, interested in what others think, is you probably could take some more risks, particularly if you're bringing people in to sort of do a specific mission and they kind of have specific kind of relevant experience externally. And then the final thing I wanted to touch on is pay. I mean, the obvious point is civil service and private sector pay massively divergent, but I think it's actually more interesting to look at civil service pay in terms of real-term decreases and also compared to the wider public sector. So we got some indicative benchmarking in from Korn Ferry, just kind of pretty rough. But compared to the 138K that DG's the median DG is on, according to the SSRB, you kind of have comparable public sector roles at something like 185K to 385K. That's a huge gap. I don't think it's particularly sustainable to be kind of offering kind of such low rates to your top talent. And I think also the question of kind of real terms pay, again, since 2014, DGs have had a kind of 35K decrease in their real terms pay. That is huge. And I think that that makes kind of the civil services ability to attract the best less sustainable.
Thanks, Jordan. It goes, and I'm not going to ask the three of you there. You're very welcome to comment on whether you should all be paid more, because
I'm very happy with the
IFG
too. That campaign.
It has some differential consequences for our reputation, but on that sort of, there is more, there is more external experience inside than you might think, particularly if you kind of take some of the caricatures, but also that tends to be people have kind of experienced life outside rather than kind of longer and deeper careers before you switch to the civil service. I mean, Sarah, that clearly wasn't your experience, but does that resonate or not?
I think that probably is right. I mean, I was just reflecting on my own top team, and there's nobody in my DG and the other perm sec in my department, nobody who doesn't have at least 3 years experience outside government. And so I think I've totally recognised that picture. People with a variety of third sector, private sector, other bits of government. It is actually a pretty diverse picture. The point about shallowness, yes, maybe in quite a lot of cases, but I think that reflects what we're talking about, which is that by the time you get to these roles, and DGs and permanent secretaries, and this sounds awful coming from the mouth of a permanent secretary, but these are very senior jobs indeed in our system, right? So we're talking about, you know, the tiniest of layers right at the top. And I don't think it's surprising that when you look at that layer, you've got a lot of people who've built up a lot of skills in exactly these kind of industry specific, and I use the word industry advisably because I think that's the scale that we're talking about here. It's not company specific, it's industry specific, these industry specific skills. I think you would see a really different picture if you start cutting it in different ways, as Kat was describing. So our colleagues who are permanent secretaries, but who have more kind of particular and specialist roles in the system, tend to have much more external background than your kind of classic head of department running a shop, particularly a kind of a policy shop like the one that I look after. That's where you see the highest concentration of people who've really built up this kind of civil service skill set. And I'm not sure that's wrong. You know, whether the balance is exactly right, we could debate, but that picture sort of seems maybe right to me. And your question about, you know, recruiting somebody directly in from the outside to run a department without any previous knowledge of how government works, I think that'd be quite a risky proposition.
I mean, that's what's interesting. I think your phrase about risk is exactly the right way to frame it. I mean, if you look at the McKinsey work on external hires into the private sector, that's the way they frame it. They basically say external hires are high risk, high reward. There's a big variability in terms of how the performance works. And I looked into the data on sort of what is the benchmark for private sector external hires. If you look at Russell Reynolds, they say C-suite hires currently are running at about three quarters internal versus a quarter external, trending upwards in the last 10 years, which surprised me. What they don't say, though, is how many of those external hires are from outside the industry. Yeah. How often is, say, someone coming in to run a retailer from, say, banking or wherever? And I think that's a real sort of parallel we have to draw here. But I think there's more experience than once you lift the lid. Certainly in my shop, you know, I've got someone who was a Clifford Chance partner for over 35 years. So you do get this experience, but it's how you help people on board quickly. Mm. That's what I'm talking about making the rules of the game more explicit. And I think the formalization, I think, of what we've particularly seen in things like finance, I think what Kat's done that has been absolutely excellent. If you look in my world on trade, we had no trade capacity, obviously, at the time of the Brexit referendum. That's a formalised profession. It's a profession as well that exists in legal services firms globally. So we're able to bring people in because people understood what a trade negotiator was. When we just use the language of a HEO policy advisor, that's, you know, what on earth is that from someone who's not steeped in the government system?
John, did you want to come in and then I'll come to Kat?
Yeah, I mean, just on what Sarah was saying, I mean, genuinely interested in your views about the extent to which sort of being a, I mean, I hate the term, but sort of policy generalist in government, to what extent is that sort of an intrinsically governmental skill set, or how different is it to, e.g., being a partner at McKinsey or an in-house strategy team at FTSE? Like, you know, how different is this job? I'm just interested.
Kat, do you want to come back on anything that we've talked about and then pick up any?
Yeah, well, I might just pick up that question, and Sarah should definitely add to this. So I think we underestimate just how transferable a lot of policy skills are between the private sector and what we do. I mean, fundamentally, it's strategy. And every other organisation I've ever been to has got a strategy function of some sort. And we have some of the best strategists in the world. Like, our strategy and policy teams have to think through very complex issues, often on an international level. So I think we underplay and undervalue the skills of policy in the outside world, and we undervalue the importance of being able to get things done in government as well, to Sarah's point earlier on. And I thought I should probably tackle head on this point about pay, Jordan. Someone's got to. And I think, first off, you know, we shouldn't in any way assume that, you know, pay is everything when it comes to our attractiveness or our ability to recruit people. It's certainly important as an overall factor, and we are never going to be able to compete with quite a lot of sectors and industries and for skills that we need. In my experience, we are able to compete where we talk about the overall offer that we can provide. People who want to give back to society, who want to work in the privileged positions that we have influencing and shaping change for the country, to have the very unique opportunity to try and develop new policy and deliver complex, difficult things. The variety of the civil service, quite frankly, is our superpower. So if you think about the outcomes that we're trying to achieve, we want people to join the civil service, have a varied career, flex different muscles, different skills, have different experiences, get to do some really interesting, diverse things. And I think you can very happily spend your whole career in the civil service doing really unique, fascinating things. But pay is obviously always going to be an issue. We need to look at pensions as well. I think we underplay pensions when we talk about the overall reward package. Very few private sector organisations can compete with us when it comes to pensions. In the short term, obviously, there's only so much that we can do, but we are looking at how we bridge the gap, particularly with some of our specialist skills and specialist areas. And we do fight very hard to change the overall package for where we need to compete. I think the government commercial function has done a great job in being able to look at the offer in the round and develop a whole different way of looking at recruiting commercial specialists to government. So pay is always going to be something that is never straightforward. We're never going to be able to be even and compete with most of the markets that ideally we want to recruit from. So we have to look at other levers available.
Just on the pensions point, we did a bit of work a couple of years ago on senior civil service pay, and it involves all sorts of assumptions because people's pay settlements are complicated, but found that basically the pension makes up about half the difference between your standard of the gap between a standard civil service job and a private sector equivalent. So more flexibility on that, more flexibility for permanent secretaries, and on how you use the pension reward seems kind of critical to me. Sarah, did you want to come back?
I wonder if I might just come back on the point about similarity versus difference. And I'm sorry, it's one of those sort of annoying answers that says it depends. And you know, the issues that I've spent most of my time in government working on, things like, you know, how do we work with businesses during COVID, or how do we think about the country's net zero strategy, or how do we think about helping tech startups scale? You know, these are issues where I think the sort of the scope of policy and strategy thinking bears quite a strong resemblance to the sort of thinking that you might be doing in all sorts of other contexts. But if you were coming on to work on some of the really tough social policy issues that we work on, for example, there'd be a different set of background that was really valuable to do that. It's not as simple as you know, that the private sector policy, the private sector strategy work fits into policy like this. It depends the nature of the policy that you're doing. And I think we should be very clear that we're going to create roles that have different needs, and then we're going to go out and find people who have great skills to come in and work on whatever that may be, wherever they may be, with no sort of sense of kind of fetishizing private sector backgrounds over public sector backgrounds or vice versa.
Can I ask, before I will come to a round of questions in the room and then online as well, but one other sort of general question, which is that another critique is often that there can be a kind of organ rejection of people who come from different backgrounds in the civil service. And Gareth, you talked about the sort of unwritten rules of organisations, and clearly all organisations have them. It strikes me the civil services rules are quite strong, and there are certain behaviours that are quite strongly rewarded inside the civil service. I mean, firstly, your experience of that, and secondly, you know, does that exist? And if it does, how does it need to be broken down?
Look, you may have a selection bias of the people who are around around this group here, who so would probably say, no, on balance, no. Look, there is a deep, obviously, there are deep cultures. It's a storied institution that has been there for literally hundreds of years, and it does develop a way of working. And sometimes the things that makes it unique can be quite impenetrable. So quite what the parliamentary process is, the exact nature of the relationship between your Secretary of State, the Treasury, and Downing Street can't really be written down on a piece of paper. Or if it is, it will miss out what's actually important. And so I'm an optimist, so maybe I'm being glass half full here, but I don't think there's a rejection of civil servants of experience that's gained outside. Certainly, if I look in my organisation, we have a wide range of experience. We value people who've got private sector experience in sectors. So, for example, the automotive team in the Department for Business. Now, as someone who's on the, we have people who've worked in automotive. We've got advisors who are on the global board of Ford, for example. And the teams draw on those sort of skills, knowledge, day in, day out. So I don't think there's a real recognition of the value that can be brought. But there is something about the way in which we work. And this is what I mean about being more explicit. I think the Sam Friedman work on, Navigating the Labyrinth was excellent. And it sort of set out quite how often we don't see the slightly unusual way in which we operate. So I think that explicitness is absolutely critical. So I don't think it is I don't buy the organ rejection point. I just think it's something about being explicit. As I say, all organisations face this sort of build, buy, borrow question for talent. And the key for me is driving out of a real deep understanding of the challenge you're facing, what your organisational goals are, and we face big challenges as a country. We need what skills and capabilities you need to bring in, and as I say, what you're looking to build internally as much as what you're looking to bring in from outside. I do think this debate also risks missing another aspect of this. Yes, it's important to bring in external talent, but it's just as important to retain our great internal talent as well. And looking at that in the round is critical.
If I might comment on the organ rejection point, and definitely a selection bias problem, I found it okay so far. But I think there are two things, and it's a very similar line of conversation to what Gareth was saying. I think there are cultural homogeneity problems in the civil service. I don't think it's about the civil service versus outsiders. I think it is, and I think this is widely recognised, right? I don't think I'm saying anything new or controversial here. Firstly, we still have more to do, even though we have done a lot, on the status and respect accorded to deep functional experts and ensuring that the seat next to the minister, which will always be a really critical one in our system. There's no way of getting away from that. But we need to constantly work to make sure that kind of seat next to the minister is sitting on a level with the kind of seat next to the project and the people who really understand the technicalities and what's happening on the ground. And that will be, I think that journey will never be complete. We just have to keep course correcting for that, because the force of the ministerial power rightly sits at the heart of our system. So that's one. And the second is issues of diversity and inclusion, particularly as they apply to social class, where we know the civil service has a lot more to do. And I think that, back to the sort of navigating the labyrinth point, that's not really about civil service background versus private sector background. It's about a whole series of other more complex unspoken cues that go well beyond the specifics of, you know, parliamentary. And I worry about those two more than I worry about the kind of private sector organ rejection problem, which I think is potentially a little bit exaggerated.
Just to add to the chorus of navigating the labyrinth, I mean, we've talked about it from this stage before, but it really is. I mean, I read that and thought, oh, gosh, yeah, that was, it was quite a salutary read. So I completely agree with that. Kat, anything further on the cultural point from you? And then Jordan, because to tee you up, some of our research doesn't quite accord with some of the views that we've heard. So I'll give you the hospital pass of that. But Kat?
Well, I really agree with Sarah's point about we know we've got some cultural homogeneity challenges. I think things are changing now. I feel quite optimistic about some of the things that will make a difference in the future. So if I look at Places for Growth, huge shift in our regional presence, creating much wider pools upon which we can go and recruit from different places, different backgrounds. You know, the fact that we've now got 18,000 people out of London who would never have been able to join the civil service, I think makes a massive, massive difference. And I was just looking at the stats on secondments, because I hadn't quite appreciated until I took up this job just how much porosity there already is between other parts of the public sector and the private sector and government. And last year we had 959 secondments out and about 596 coming in. That's a big shift compared to where we are. So I think the more you have porosity, the more we're recruiting in different ways, the more that we are going externally. I think it means that we've got a pipeline and a shift that will come in time. It's a kind of cohort-based issue for us. So feeling optimistic.
Cool, thank you. Jordan, anything on...
Yeah, I mean, lots to pick up. I mean, on this question of sort of functional roles and how senior they feel, I mean, I've been arguing for a long time for what I call, or I think others call it as well, senior specialist roles. Basically roles where there's kind of a technical track in an organisation and you can rise and become more high profile without necessarily having to take on more high management work. And you see that a lot in banks. You see it in the Bank of England, in Microsoft. The civil service doesn't really have an equivalent. I think that does put kind of a particular hard ceiling on people who are kind of good at knowing and doing, but don't necessarily want to manage and their career. On this question of culture, I mean, yeah, we have unfortunately heard from some interviewees for the most recent project that there are different views on this. I think what was striking to me is the extent to which some of the criticisms in Catherine Baxendale's report, I think it was a decade ago now, are still kind of echoed of this idea of kind of slight disdain of private sector expertise, this idea of kind of a very strong dominant culture, which actually in organisations can often be very good because it shows there's kind of a clear sense of purpose and mission, but also one that kind of outsiders can find quite hard to penetrate, and people are sort of perfectly nice to you, but will kind of not let you in on the kind of second level meaning of what's going on. So I think that kind of did come across. Finally, on the kind of social class point, I mean, the socioeconomic data that's out there isn't great, but I think an okay proxy, it's not an amazing proxy for all kinds of reasons, but is Oxbridge attendance. And we found that 52% of Permsex and DGs went to Oxbridge. I'm a bit heretical in this in the sense that they're like two of the best universities in the world. I don't think it's crazy that a substantial proportion of the senior civil service and indeed the very top roles go to people that went there. I think where it becomes a problem is if it reflects kind of biasing people because of their credentials or their kind of like stylized behaviours rather than for their achievements, essentially. And I think, you know, I'll leave it to others to decide what is kind of the case currently.
Thank you. Questions then? We've got a roving mic in the room. Please, we'll take questions in two or three. Wait for the microphone to come to you and then make sure that your question is clear. If you can, say who you are. If there is anybody in the adjoining room, probably not, then do come into the main room and we will come to some online questions as well. So there's one there.
Thank you, Emily Roach, partner at Newton. I recently left the civil service after 5 years, or returned to the private sector after 5 years in the civil service. And so interesting to hear some of the reflections on organ rejection or not. And not totally my experience, but I do agree that external skills aren't always valued enough. And I also wanted to ask the panel's thoughts on on retaining external talent. I think Catherine Baxendale showed that external people who do join leave in higher numbers, yeah. and particularly high performers leave in higher numbers than your standard civil servant. And is there much thought going into how can you better retain those people, or indeed stay in touch with people when they've gone who may then come back later, to Kat's kind of porosity point?
Thank you, Emily. And there's another question online from Alistair Baldwin about retention. Would the civil service be better at retaining top talent if it was more porous externally, allowing more civil servants to leave on secondments in return,
yeah.
which goes a bit to Emily, to your point there, but also to what Kat was saying. So another question, what's in the room? We'll go there and then there.
Thank you. Gus Stugenhat, Tussle. We're a data analytics company, and using the government's own data, we can report that in the latest fiscal year, the wider public sector spent about £7 billion with recruitment companies. £7 billion. To put that in perspective, it's only about 3% of total procurement budget, but it's a lot. It's more than twice how much the government spent on consultancy, which gets a lot more attention. So my question to you is, does £7 billion per year feel like value for money?
Mm-hmm. Great question. Thank you. And at the front here.
Thanks, Alex. My name's Matthew Trimming. I'm senior advisor at Public and do a few other things as well. A lot on attracting talent, and a few questions already on how you retain talent. One thing that I think Whitehall, having spent 25 years in this place, could do and learn a little bit from the private sector, is that once you're in, creating sort of a set of relationships that are cross-cutting in functional areas that are sort of outside of one's department. I would say that about every other month, someone who's a deputy director or director phones me or emails me and says, do you know anybody who's like really good in data? I had something from DEFRA the other day, and I said, well, do you know the head of data at MOD? She's absolutely brilliant. Oh, no, I don't know her, actually. Could you connect us? Well, of course I can connect them. That's not a problem. But that is a silly anecdote for where there is a lot of opportunity to sort of make people feel a lot more part of the organisation when you give them sort of cross-cutting relationships, particularly in sort of policy departments such as Sarah's, or, you know, to a certain extent, you know, Kat's area as well, where people move around a lot, and therefore having them, you know, building their own sort of knowledge base and network can only help retain them, I would have thought. Great. Just keen to hear people's thoughts on that.
Thanks, Matthew. Three good questions. There were lots of more questions in the room as well, so let's do short answers and maximal questions. So, Emily, on retaining people with external skills, Gus's £7 billion value for money on recruitment, and Matthew on embedding cross-cutting relationships. Kat, do you want to kick us off with any of those?
Yeah, sure. Very quickly on each of them. So, Emily, I mean, you're a fantastic example of someone who's been in the civil service, is now out at Newton. I really hope one day you'll come back. And I think your question about, you know, this evidence of people who come from the outside not spending as long as a civil servant, I think it's really mixed. You know, and you've got to accept that when you recruit people with skills that are valid in lots of different competitive labour markets, that they may choose to move in different ways. But actually, my experience is people do tend to stay for a long time. I think we three are probably case in point. I've just announced that Tom Reed is leaving us as the chief exec of the Government Digital Service. He spent 9 years in the civil service doing a fantastic job before he returns. Gareth Rees-Williams, another example of a senior commercial professional going back after 8 years as the head of the commercial function. So I think it's hard to generalise. Obviously, we want to get value from people whilst they're here. £7 billion on recruitment. I don't really know if that's value for money, but as you say, it's a fraction of the £1,226 billion that the public sector spent last year. And so I kind of think, you know, if that's helping us to recruit diversely in lots of different parts of the public sector, it could be. But I probably shouldn't comment without more data. And then to the final point, like I think I've certainly benefited from being in the finance function, because you sort of work horizontally. And we've introduced a very sophisticated matrix structure to government. Like when I first joined the civil service, we were very, very siloed and very horizontal. So the more the functions and all of the professions, and I would include policy and Ofdel in this, create networks, workers, communities of practice to manage talent effectively across government, the better. It's a really good thing.
Gareth, on the retention point, yeah, you raised it before. So both Emily and Matthew's points there.
Yeah, no, I think this retention point is absolutely critical. I mean, as I said, it's external recruits tend to be more high risk. And I think the evidence would suggest in the on the private sector as well, you'd have a bigger variation of how long people actually stay. It's great when people come in and stay for a long time. But I am interested as well in what can we do to encourage people to do essentially a period of service to their country? So is there a way in which, maybe you don't, you know, breaking the old perception of the civil service as being in a 20 out at retirement age, but instead coming in for a period in your career, say 5 years, being able to draw on your private sector experience, say, sector experience in a particular maybe functional area, and give that back to the country. I think how we structure that, and that's not just about the attraction, it's also about how we, you know, how we help people both succeed in the role, but also exit well. And of course, you've got to manage the propriety around this. But the ACABA rules sometimes cast a very large shadow, and a lot of people are worried about joining, feeling they're going to be restricted from what they can do in future. And quite how we weave our way through that, I think, is absolutely critical. But I do think this general point around retention and how we give people clear career paths, be they whether they've come in externally or whether they come in into, or they've been grown internally, is absolutely critical. So sometimes too much of that, again, is implicit into what we do.
Just to pick up very briefly on the ACABA point, I mean, it seems to me fairly sensible that the civil service should just move to a system of kind of contractual obligations where it's written into your contracts before you join government and what you are and are able to do once you've left that job. And I think that the ACABA point is one that comes up a lot when we talk to senior people, is that there is a, in their minds anyway, great degree of uncertainty about what it means for their future career.
Yeah.
And that causes problems when they think about coming into government, because they're like, I'm not quite sure what my exit route is. And if you are someone that wants to do that tour of duty, that isn't very attractive to you.
Got a cheeky one from online from Anonymous, Sarah, which, it's not that cheeky. But how much insight do PermSecs have into what applying for entry-level or middle-grade jobs means into the civil service? Should DGs and PermSecs be required to use the same processes?
I'm sure the answer is not nearly enough insight,
yeah.
But I also think we probably would all recognise that at times applying for jobs can be quite painful.
Mm.
I think, by the way, that's true of lots of other organisations too. Most recruitment processes I've gone through haven't been entirely fun. I do think it's an important part of this conversation that we haven't really touched on, which is that we have we're on the spectrum between really having a very clear set of values about open and fair competition versus being about kind of talent managing people into the right roles. The civil service leans pretty far over to kind of to the left, not in a political sense, on that spectrum. And that does mean, you know, quite regimented processes.
Yeah.
I know external people, even for our, not our civil service roles, but for things like our board memberships and non-execs across our arm's length bodies, those sorts of things, people often find it a bit shocking to find themselves in an interview for a non-exec role that's sort of formal and has some criteria. There's pros and cons both sides. We're at one end of the spectrum at the moment. It's not an obvious thing that we should necessarily move over to a, you know, much more casual, speedy, I tap you up, I put you in process. I think there's real trade-off there.
There's quite an interesting debate, I think, happening now and about to happen around that and how far sort of judgment is used. But we'll do another round of questions in the room. There's been a very dedicated hand in the middle there, so I'll go to you first and then go around the rest of the room.
Thank you. My name is Charles Hipps. I am the CEO of Olio, and I have spent 25 years putting in recruitment platforms and processes into some of the world's most, or largest and most successful organisations, both within public and private sector. So I guess the simple questions I have to ask are, how much strategic work do you put into your recruitment today? because I think recruitment is incredibly strategic today, because we're facing a world of huge change where we have historical lows in terms of the number of people available to recruit, and people's perspective of work have changed substantially. So it's really important you have deep strategic processes. And then my other question is really, as a CEO of my of Olio, I think a lot about, when I bring people in, is how much change can my organization absorb and how much change do I want to drive? Because there are incredibly talented people within the civil service, and there are obviously incredibly talented people outside the civil service. And in some ways, the mix of what you want to do is driven by how much change you want to drive, because people bring change with them because they are used to working in different ways.
Thank you very much.
Sorry, long question.
Yeah, that's all right. Interesting. Lord Burt, who's at the front there, and then I'll come to the back.
John Burt, House of Lords. I worked at Number 10 for 6 years, doing long-term strategy projects, including with a bright young civil servant who's sitting next to you now.
Good grounding.
The first thing I would observe is, don't underestimate the enormous strength of the British Civil Service. I'm an unalloyed admirer of it, and nobody's mentioned any names so far, but the wisdom contained in people like Jeremy Haywood or Robin Butler. This is about understanding the business of government. You cannot import that from the private sector. It's a completely different professional skill, and this discussion has slightly underplayed it. However, what did I think 20 years ago the real weaknesses were, and Gareth by my side would have observed some of these things, is that the functional ability of government was chronically weak, really weak financial capability, really weak classic strategic capability, virtually no data analytical capability. Now, I think the reassuring thing about this conversation is I think I'm hearing that has got better. I've worked continuously in the private sector as well as the House of Lords since I left Number 10. And I sit opposite teams now with a top data person, a top market person, a top operations person, a brilliant finance person. I've done this any number of times. The quality of skills in the best private sector companies is mouthwatering. The ability to get under the skin of issues and to understand at great depth. So I think I'm hearing that it's a hell of a lot better, but it would be good to hear from the panel, because I'm fully aware that the scale of problems that government faces is absolutely enormous wherever you look and wherever you turn, and they're not only short term but they're long term, and arguably we've not done very well at solving long term problems in this country in recent times. Is it getting better?
Yeah, great, thank you. And a very quick one at the end there, and then we'll have short answers.
Thank you. I'm Ben Alexander. I'm here in my role as a commercial advisor to the civil service through the Cabinet Office, I should say. I just want to pick up on Lord Burt's point about sort of the talent within. And I think the civil service has a natural tendency to undersell itself, actually. But I've lost count of the number of times I've been in situations where people have described themselves to me as not commercial, and I think they are. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I was going to try and suggest is, in a commercial organisation, those people will be spotted straight away, because that's what the organisation does. But actually, you've got a lot of commercial people within you because you're just a big organisation. Yeah. And if you could find a way, and financial people too, I see them all the time, if you could find a way of bringing on those people within your policy teams, I think that would have two effects. One is, I think it would just be very useful for policy making. But two, I think it would help the bridge with the functions which are being established and I think are very important.
Great.
Apologies, that wasn't actually a question, but...
Thank you very much. We'll keep speeding through. Kat, do you want to pick up on the kind of overall recruitment points that we heard from Charles first about sort of strategic work that goes into recruitment and how much thought about that?
Yeah, I'll be quite frank about it. I don't think we have as much capacity to be strategic as we would like, and that's partly because we're doing a lot. to operationally deliver some very much needed improvements to our recruitment processes. So if you look at the government people plan, it is all about making sure that we have good processes that treat our people well. We are going to be looking at the people strategy in the context of the overall civil service strategy. But I think at the moment, I don't apologise for the amount of effort that's going into getting today in better shape. And very briefly, would you mind if I just comment on functions? Because it's something I'm particularly passionate about. I really agree with the last comment about how we move people with functional expertise in and out of policy. Some of our best finance directors, CFOs, chief commercial officers have come from the policy profession. And it's because we've said, come and spend some time, get a qualification, come and test your policy skills in a more corporate professional environment. And they have really thrived. And we underestimate just how important that is. And to Lord Burt's question, I'm completely biased, but I really do believe that our functional expertise is a lot better. When I first joined the civil service, we still thought it was okay for CFOs and directors general responsible for billions of pounds to not have a financial qualification. That would be completely unheard of in today's civil service, and we are so much better for it. And not only that, we've got brilliant talent coming through our functional pipelines, ready to take over with the right qualifications and the right experience. So it's changed enormously, but we can never take it for granted.
Thanks, Kat. And I'll come to Sarah Jordan and Gareth for a sort of final response, but particularly sort of acknowledging John Burt's point about the sort of the skills of certain types of civil servants and the need for that kind of bleed through. Also recognising, and I would agree that things have got a lot better on the, you know, on the functions, but rather than giving you that softball question, what's the next frontier on the functions?
That's exactly where I was going to come in. And just to say, I completely agree about this point around governmental skills. And indeed, that's kind of where I started at the very beginning. Let's not underplay no amount of however wonderful your experience outside Whitehall is. And we really want it and need it, but it can't substitute for also having people around who really, really know the system. And exactly the same is true in every other industry I've ever seen. The next frontier, back to the point around kind of strategic approaches to talent, we've done a huge amount on all of the functions and professions, including digital and data, and we are in a much, much stronger position than we were. But like every other organisation out there, we are in, I know it's a cliche, a war for digital data and AI talent, and that is going to continue to be a really, really big strategic challenge for us, and we are going to have to run immensely fast, you know, just to stand still comparatively. So I think we're like super aware of that. We've done some fantastic stuff so far. We've recruited some of the world's leading AI safety researchers into DSIT, into the Safety Institute. I think it's been a really impressive piece of work, but that's like, you know, one step out of 50 we're going to need to take.
Cool. Next frontier?
John and I worked a lot around deepening the analytics and strategic muscles at the centre of government. I think the next frontier actually is building on that into data analytics. We did a lot through COVID with use of real-time data, but the depth of data analytics that I see as possible in private sector organisations, there's still an air gap. We have pockets of that. You know, we've got some interesting work we're doing in our shop on mapping supply chains. We're now able to map supply chains across the world down to 5 levels, but there's a lot more we need to do on that. And I think that comfort with data analytics and that use around the decision-making tables is going to be absolutely critical. And I actually think the next frontier of this is less around the functions, which I think are maturing really well. We've talked about finance. I think the work on project management has actually been excellent, and the use of the SRO system has actually completely turned around the way in which some of our major projects are managed. I actually think it's much more now about subject expertise, and this is what, Jordan, you touched on. It's within policy. It's unpacking what we mean by policy. And there are some things which is around the business of government, which is around how you get things done in Whitehall. But actually, within subject areas, how we create the right incentives for people to build depth of understanding around education skills, around what industrial policy looks like, around what defence policy looks like. I think too much over the last 10 years, we've emphasised the horizontal skills. Some actually building those vertical silos of expertise is going to be really important.
I really agree with that. Hugely true in energy policy, digital policy, absolutely.
Jordan, very quick last word. And then
two very quick points. First, I mean, just on that, I mean, we've talked a lot about kind of career anchors. So basically, kind of civil servants move around a lot, as I'm sure everyone in this room knows. But can you move around a theme? So like crime and justice or environment and net zero. And I think that kind of is partly an answer to that kind of vertical question. And then the final thing is just something Kat alluded to at the very beginning and picks up on what Sarah was saying, was this question of like spotting talent as a skill, which is increasingly something that the private sector is really interested in. Some really innovative organisations out there, Entrepreneur First, who are run by one of the government's AI advisors, for example, some really interesting work going on in the private sector. There are some people that seem to have kind of a good taste for talent. Is that something that can scale in a kind of civil service context?
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you to the panel and to everybody here and on the live stream. I'm sorry we didn't get through more of your questions, but I did try to work plenty of them in. The event live stream will be available to watch on our website and on YouTube in a couple of days. And a plug from the report we've mentioned a couple of times, Who Runs Whitehall, which is out later this week, looking at the background, appointment and pay of the most senior civil servants. And check out our website for some other excellent events. We've got one tomorrow about what makes a successful communications strategy in the context of the upcoming election. Lucy Powell is coming on the 14th of May, and on the 15th of May, a discussion about Parliament and regulators and how to improve scrutiny. Thank you all very much, and see you then.